So Lawrence Gunther earned a master's in environmental studies from York University in 1994, all the while working summers, fishing aboard traditional wooden dories, hand lining for cod off Canada's east coast. Being registered blind at the age of 8, he went on to invent the blind fishing boat. Lawrence has competed professionally as a tournament fisher throughout North America and has become one of Canada's top 10 sponsored pro fishers. He's widely known for his seminars and articles on the theme, Feel the Bite. I'm curious to know whether he also detects the smell of mint when searching for a good fishing spot.
Well, thanks for inviting me to talk and share a little bit during this really cool two-day presentation. It's really excellent speakers. I'm learning a lot. And I hope I can share some insights that other people will find interesting. I've been fishing, like Jack, all my life, and I started off probably around 3 or 4 years of age. My parents bought an old farmstead in central Ontario. There was a spring coming out of the side of a hill, and my dad said, let's put a pond here. So I had a bulldozer come in, scooped out a big hole. It was amazing. Within a week, it was full of water, and then a big truck came and dumped in all sorts of baby trout, and I grew up with those trout. I learned to fish on that pond. I learned to observe the fish and all the creatures that came to inhabit that pond, the crayfish, the dragonflies, the frogs, the ducks, the heron, all the birds. It was just, it became a complete ecosystem. In the 80s, now this was the mid-60s. By the early 80s, the water became really clear. The trees on that property started, the tops of the trees started to die off, and everyone started talking about acid rain. And you could see that the fish were suffering, that the frog population was dropping off, and a number of other creatures that had made home in that pond were starting to disappear. In the 90s, that pond was still there, and there were still fish. They were still hanging in there. But the summer started, the water started getting really warm. And I could tell that something wasn't right. The fish were starting to show signs of stress from the warm water. And people started talking about climate change and global warming. And to me, I could see that in my very own pond, that case was the case. Now, nature took that pond back in the end. It was at the base of a hill, and over 30 years of erosion, that pond gradually filled in little by little, inch by inch. Doesn't take much every year, rains coming down the hill and sediment eroding into the bottom of the pond, and it gets shallower and shallower. And at some point, my brothers decided that they would re-excavate the whole pond and start over. In the end, nature triumphed, and that's my point there. Nature took back. You know, I went off to college and university, and in the summers, I had a little cabin on the east coast of Canada, and I convinced some of the local fishers there to take me out cod fishing. And it was hard because they said they'd taken mainlanders out before. You know, you get out there 3 hours, and your boat's rocking and rolling, and the guy gets sick, and they have to turn around, come back 3 hours, and then go back out 3 hours. They just wasted 6 hours of, you know, half their day of fishing because of some mainlander that can't has no sea legs. But I had sea legs, so I was able to tough it out. We caught, my first day out, we caught 3,000 pounds of cod just with hand line, just black Dacron line, a jig on the end of the hook, dropping it down 200-300 feet down, jigging, pulling up these cod by hand. Filled the back of the boat. We had so many cod in the back of this boat, a homemade wooden 35-foot dory with the engine right at the front. I was like, why do they put the car engines at the very front of the dory? It's because if you fill the back of it up with fish and it sinks, the motor's at the front, so the motor's still going to be above water level, and it's still going to be running even if the back of the boat is pretty much underwater, which was our case. So they made me drive back, even though I could just barely see a little bit of the sun. So I just steered by the sun at that point, the 4 hours drive back, and while they cleaned the fish, they were worried I'd cut myself with the sharp fillet knives as they were cleaning the fish at the back of the boat, so I had to drive the boat. And I became a crew, and I did that every summer. While I went through university and I got my master's in environmental studies at York University, I graduated, and I left Canada in 1990. I went to Sweden for a year, and I studied over there for a year, and I studied there environmental activities and over there. But in 92, when I came back from Sweden, that was my last season of fishing because they closed the cod fishery. And I think that's the very first time us as humans realized that we could actually wipe out a fish species, you know, that all these people that had fished for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years the same way, wooden boats, you know, very primitive technology on these boats. Everyone just knew the water. They knew how to get around. I mean, I drive my little plastic boat, my kayak, blind, and people think, well, that's amazing. You must have amazing technology. I think, well, yeah, I have technology, but most of the time I don't even turn it on because, you know what? People have been doing it for hundreds of years just in the fog, by the smell of the land, the feel of the waves, the echo of the sound off the rocks, you know, the birds. It's just, there's so many things that tell you about your environment, where you are in your environment. But we're so focused on our ability to see that we forget that there's all these other ways of feeling and being in your environment. So I use that. But these guys had done it for 500 years in Canada, right? We came here almost 500 years ago because of the cod. And we were doing really well, and the cod were doing really well up until 1980s when the offshore trawlers came in, and Canada licensed its own offshore trawlers. And 10, 15 years later, the cod stocks were wiped out. And now we know, with the fleet and the technologies we have, we can move in on a stock of fish, a wild fish stock, in a part of the world, and within 10 to 15 years, we'll take 90%, we'll basically decimate that stock. So we've learned now that we can harvest to the point of extinction. And that's been a big change for all of us who fish. You know, like Jack said, how do you learn to fish? You know, people used to teach fish. You'd have a stringer or a creel, and you'd throw your string out with fish, you'd put the fish in the creel. There was no idea of giving them back. Tournament fishing in the 60s and 70s and 80s was all about keeping the fish and weighing in your dead fish. And then with all of this change, I mean, we all had to learn to conserve our resource. And that's so new in the big picture things. I mean, think about it. You look at all the stories in the Bible about, you know, catching fish, right? And, I mean, there's some of the earliest documented fish stories that we all know and heard about, and, you know, going back 2,000 years. And nothing really has changed until the last 20 or so years. We've had to change, and we're infants. We're infants. We're babies in terms of understanding conservation, how to take care of this resource. I mean, we wiped out so many other resources, right? Beaver, buffalo, you know, we're just exploiting minerals and oil, you know, lumber, clear cutting. We do all these things that just, you know, take it off the land and sell it. And we were doing it with commercial fishing, and we did it recreationally as well. But I think now we're starting to realize that we can't do it, and we just don't know that much about it. And we don't know how to do it, but we're teaching ourselves. And I think people who love fishing, and there's so many fishing clubs, and there's 19 million people in Canada who claim to be fishers. Maybe they don't fish every year, but they still claim to have fish and like fishing and would fish again given the opportunity. 19 million Canadians. More adults in Canada fish than play golf and hockey combined. It's an $8.3 billion industry annually. That's 2010 stats. $8.3 billion was generated just by recreational fishing. One of the top five tourism reasons people come to Canada is to fish. Even within Canada, one of the top five things Canadians do on vacation is fish. That's why if we're going touring around within Canada, moving around, it's to go fish. So it's a huge part of our economy. It's a huge part of who we are. It's a wild grown food that we still harvest, and it's probably one of the last wild grown foods that we as a population still harvest actively. And yet we're still just babies in terms of how to understand what we're doing to these fish populations, and we're still in so many ways out of control, just totally out of control. And I understand, you know, hunters got beat up pretty good in the 70s and 80s by a lot of environmental groups for hunting. But and they had to learn to become ethical hunters, how to harvest ethically, how to determine which animals can be harvested, how to harvest them with causing the least amount of injury or agony to the beasts and the animals. And we haven't learned to do that yet with fishing. That still hasn't happened. The ethical fisher is still, I think fly fishers have caught that. For most other fishers, that we're just now starting to learn it. Fishing tournaments, you know, it's all catch and release now. If you bring in a dead fish, if you have five fish and one of them is dead, you'll get a penalty. And that's the penalty significant enough that you could lose. You could lose the tournament from bringing in the dead fish. And then once the fish are weighed alive, using pretty technical waterway and systems, they're released back into the environment again, and hopefully back into areas where they can get back home. But fish do move around, so they just have to be brought back to in the general areas, and they'll find their way back to suitable habitat. But so we're learning how to sport fish recreationally. We're learning how to recreationally fish and to put back. We're learning what kind of fish we should keep and harvest and which ones need to be put back. But even that, I mean, even the scientists, really, I mean, they're so immature when it comes to this sort of stuff. Like, we just had, you know, the province of Ontario, for instance, is broken down to all these different zones. In the zone here in eastern Ontario, called Zone 18, they said you could keep walleye, four walleye under 15 inches and one over 20. That was walleye as a species of fish. And then they realized the fish population, that species is still falling. So now they said, you know what? Now you can only keep walleye, five of them, but they have to be between 16 and 20 inches in size. And they have it in metric as well. I think it's, I won't even guess what it is in metric, but that's, I'm dating myself, you know. I was in school when they made the change. But anyway, there you go. Fishers still talking pounds and inches for the most part. So they have to be between 16 and 20 inches because they know the walleye over 20 inches for the breeders. We want to let them go. But how can they make that flip-flop? Like, one minute the science is saying, keep the ones over 20 and the ones under 16. Nope, now they're changing around. Nope, change their minds. Now you keep the ones between 16 and 20. Yeah, that's the right way. I said, well, where's your science? Well, you know, it's still evolving. But where was the science that told you to do it the other way? Well, yeah, that's still... you know, we're not sure. So, I mean, we don't even do really good science when it comes to a lot of this stuff. Conservation and fish, we don't even know. So, can you imagine what people think about water and the fish, the water that these fish live in? It barely registers. It barely registers. I mean, we're here talking about water as H2O. And talking about what Angus says, you know, you got to make some emotional contact. Because if you're just looking at H2O, let's keep H2O pure, and then people just think, well, you know, it doesn't have to be that pure because everyone's thinking I got a filter on my tap, or I got a Brita filter, or I got chlorination, or I got UV now filtration. I don't care. You know, I filter it at my house, and it comes out clean, it's safe to drink, whatever. You know, who cares? And that's what when you're just talking about clean water, that's the kind of attitude that I think the majority of the population, an average person is going to think, look, as long as my city is doing or my town's doing a good job filtering water, it's good. You know, I'm okay. You know, there's no big crisis. So making a clean water argument, it's not a really powerful argument. If you're going to say that the water is becoming poisonous and toxic and it's creating the whole environment change, our whole world is going to change, you know, no one's been able to make that argument yet. Heck, we can't even barely make the argument that the climate's changing. So what's the argument? You can't swim in the water? Well, that can get a few people upset if they can't go to their beach and swim, for sure. Or all these cottage owners. And we were talking yesterday about cows and fish and the organization and the blue-green algae, the bacteria there. And that's becoming a bigger and bigger issue. You can't, you know, you buy a piece of property, a cottage, you can't even swim in the water, you can't even let your dog go in the water, and yet people are barely talking about this. You know, does it cause your liver to die? Does it cause neurological damage? Where's the science? And how come people are telling you, don't do it, don't go in the water? How come we don't really, you know, haven't really shared this? Because there's property values at stake, and huge lawsuits, and huge fear, and people are afraid to push that fear button because of all the emotions it'll bring up. So even the whole blue-green algae thing, even though it's in all our lakes now and it's really become an epidemic, people hardly know anything about it. And medically, I mean, it's just crazy. If it was in the air, if we have blue-green algae in the air floating around, it would really freak people out. But it's in the water, and it's out of sight, out of mind. People don't really think about it. And I think that's the biggest problem. We care about our fish, care about getting good drinking water out of the tap, but we don't really care about just water being an environment. We know we love our trees, we love our air, we love our forests and mountains, and the animals that walk around and make that their home. Care about bears and seals, everything that's on top of the water, but the things that live under the water, we know almost nothing about it, and we have very little interest in it. Heck, we still dump our sewage. Most of Canadian cities still dump raw sewage straight into the rivers and lakes that they're on. Yeah, Ottawa, you know, dumps every time it rains heavy in Ottawa, we're dumping in hundreds of millions of raw sewage right into the river because we don't want our homes to back up, right? And that's not fixed. It's going to take $200 million to fix that. We don't have the money, but we just launched a $2.1 billion transit program in Ottawa to fix it, put in a new transit system. And now they found another $80 million to bury a little stretch of because it was going to be an eyesore. People who lived along this one stretch didn't want to see the trains going by, so they're going to bury that section for an extra $80 million. But we can't find $200 million to stop putting raw sewage into the Ottawa River. And people fish in that river, and then people live downstream, and they get their water out of it, and they drink it. You know, and yet, it's not even their raw sewage. I mean, we dump our treated sewage into the river with all the pharmaceuticals, and 50% of it is industrial waste sewage generated by industry, and God only knows what they're putting into it, and all the cleaners and industrial chemicals and commercial chemicals and residential chemicals that we're using to clean our homes and our laundry and our dishes. You know, that's all just going straight in the river. None of that's being filtered out through our, you know, the only thing our filtration systems are doing is taking the chunks out, really. It's making the chunk, making it less chunky so you can't see it. But, you know, and then you have, like, the city of Ottawa. On one side, you have Gatineau, big city, you know, and the other side is Ottawa on the same river. And you got two provinces controlling the laws about what kind of sewage gets dumped into the river. Ottawa says, well, we're going to chlorinate our sewage and kill all the bacteria before we dump it. And on the Quebec side, they say, we're not going to chlorinate our sewage release before it's dumped into the river because it's carcinogenic. So who do you believe? The Quebec side that says it's carcinogenic and we're just releasing live bacteria into the river, or the Ontario side? So, I mean, our science is really, really, really infantile. And I think if we're going to have any success in advancing this from where we are now, which is almost nowhere, to where we got to go to make sure that people start to feel and understand what's happening with our water and give up their need to see it, to believe it. Hell, if I didn't, you know, I don't see anything, but I still believe things are going on. We have to convince other people that just because they can't see it happening in the water, it is still happening. And they have to learn to smell it, feel it between their toes, taste it, and all, hear it and understand it. Understand it mainly, understand what their minds through us, through the information we give them. We have to start giving them rich, really well thought out, really well researched arguments, and not just say, you know, save the water. We've got to get a little more complex, a little more sophisticated. And, you know, just to end this, my piece here, I'm in a lot of fishing clubs. I do a lot of fishing tournaments. I am an environmentalist, and I still keep fish and eat them, and I'm careful which ones I eat. For the pollution chemicals and just make sure habitats and fish have a chance to survive. But all the fishing clubs, a lot of them have conservation projects that they undertake every year. And if you look at the total number of volunteer hours put into saving Canada's water, natural water systems, freshwater systems, fishing clubs put in more volunteer hours than all other organizations combined in terms of total volunteer hours. So if you don't beat up people who fish, they love it. They're learning how to make it, make sure it's around for future generations. It's a relatively new concept in terms of the big picture. We're all learning together. Let's work together. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks so much, Lauren. That was covered a lot of ground there, that presentation. I really like how you made the connection about the scope and the breadth of the fishing community and how much it contributes to our economy and amount of recreational users that are fishing. And then starting to think about how we put it all together, how do we make the public care about the issues related to water and fishing, as well as the creatures, like you said, that live in the water, and how do we make the connection to that? So I think those are a lot of great questions that you ask, and good questions also for the audience to maybe think about and mull over a little bit. Really appreciate your participation and showing us a little bit more, telling us a little bit more about the connections with your stories, your personal stories, to fishing and freshwater.